Sunday, 9 November, and you are on the NDB Sunday Show with me, Chris Steyn, and policy and political analyst, Professor Theo Venter. Welcome, Professor.
Good morning.
May we start with the government of national unity? The leaders of the 10 parties leading the government of national unity emerged from a two-day retreat with a message.
The Americans should.
What do you say?
Yes, I think last weekend was a very important milestone in the government of national unity that emerged after the election last year. And what we expected to happen fairly quickly after these 10 political parties all signed a memorandum of agreement was that there will be meetings between the political role players, or let's call them party political leaders, from time to time, apart from, of course, being in cabinet or being in parliament. And we also thought that there will be an emerging system where they can deal with crises, the so-called conflict resolution mechanism. Well, the last one took about a year, and it was only ratified this weekend. The first one, the meeting of minds from time to time, which is normal in any coalition, because if you meet in a cabinet, it's a very formal setting. If you meet in parliament, it's a very conflictual and talk house. So there's no real debate taking place. It's scoring political points. So where the really serious negotiations take place is off the record, behind closed doors, when party political leaders meet. That was not forthcoming. And all the members of the RNU, except, of course, the ANC, moaned about a lack of meeting with the president from time to time. So over the weekend last week, they've decided now that everybody's happy with the conflict resolution mechanism, and they are happy with how it will be managed. And the second thing is that they have now agreed to meetings more regularly between party political leaders. I'm putting a time to it. I would say a monthly meeting. Now, the important thing here is that it is at that meeting where when legislation is put on the parliamentary agenda or how political leaders can decide how to attack and how to approach these issues. Because what we've seen over the last year, and this has been bad for the government of national unity. At first, there was a huge expectation that this is a new page that we are now turning over after the election last year. But very soon, within 3 months, it became clear that the ANC is totally dominating the RNU, and they're ruling and governing as if they're still a two-thirds majority party, while back at home, they really only have 40%. And if you want to be cruel, they really only got 39.7%. But let's keep it at 40%. And I think what happened over this weekend is that those things were put in place, and then maybe just a little point about criticism of Thabo Mbeki on the government of national unity. He was of the opinion over the last 2 weeks that nothing is happening because they're not implementing the so-called National Development Plan, the NDP. Well, part of the decision over the weekend passed was that they have approved the medium-term policy framework, and they've approved the medium-term development plan, which is the implementation of the national development plan. In other words, it's taking the national development plan, that is a huge document, in some cases already not relevant anymore, but at least taking those points, converting it into things that you can actually implement and that each department must do, and they've accepted that. So that's progress. And I also think that the fact that the political parties agreed basically on everything. Now, there's one outstanding issue. You'll remember that when the DA and the ANC were at loggerheads, the DA threatened that they are withdrawing from the national dialogue, which is very slowly getting off the ground, far more slowly than everybody thought. And it said in the press statement that all parties agreed on basically everything. That means the DA has softly or silently moved away from that stance of not playing along with the national dialogue. I haven't heard a single word this week where the DA has said anything to the contrary, because I think they were more inundated with the issue of how to deal with Dion George and Willie Oukamp and how to fill that deputy minister's post that has been lingering for the last 3-4 months, where nobody did anything about it.
However, there does seem to be a rift in the provincial government of unity in KZN, where 4 parties rule.
Yeah, well, it's very true, and I think I'm glad that you mentioned it. When the government of national unity was formed after the election last year, the first of the agreements that were signed were the KZN one, where MK, I think, took 46% of KZN. And if they were to merge or have a coalition with the EFF, they would have been in a position to run that province. So what the ANC did behind the scenes, they went to the DA, they went to the IFP, but they still needed one seat in a legislature of 80 to make the 41-39 division, and that one seat was provided by the NFP. Now, the NFP is a breakaway party of the IFP in the days of Mangosuthu Buthelezi, and they maintained a fairly strong following in certain parts of KZN. And it is this political party, the NFP, with a leader, Mr. Barnes, that decided 2 or 3 weeks ago that they're not happy with what's going on in KZN. So over the last 2 weeks, there were intense negotiations between the IFP and the ANC, the DA, ANC, IFP, to see what they can do to keep Mr. Barnes in the government of provincial unity. And it seems to me, because there's no news coming out of it, but it seems to me they have formed some kind of agreement to keep the NFP in the provincial government of unity rather than them joining the EFF and MK. But it is a very thin kind of majority of one, and it tells you sometimes these coalition formations are inherently unstable. And I think so far in KZN, things went very well, but one or two of the IFP members were irritating people. And it's my information that between the ANC and the IFP, there was decided to move some of the MECs to other portfolios and in some cases to move them out. Now, we may expect an announcement this week when I think the president returns from his visit to the Vatican City, where he has spent his weekend, so-called working visit. And I think there will then also be this announcement whether the DA's request that one of their members be taken out of cabinet and replaced with another, whether that carries the favor of the president.
Now, meanwhile, the two inquiries into police and political capture are continuing, the Matlanga Commission and Parliament's ad hoc committee. Whose testimony struck you in particular?
The political role Yeah, maybe a little background. I think our listeners know what's going on. It's 3-4 weeks now. And if I can break the whole process into three parts, I think the first part of what we're hearing in Parliament as well as at Madlanga are the testimony of people. They are now telling their stories. The second part would be a kind of cross-examination to see which story is credible and which not. Because currently, we hear these stories and you must make up who are the good guys, who are the bad guys. Some things are already coming out. But I think this week, two of these discussions kept me glued to the whole thing. The one was Mrs. Johnson from IDAC. Now, IDAC, it's one of these abbreviations that we must get used to, is an institution that is linked to the NPA, the National Prosecuting Agency, and their focus is primarily on crime. It's a crime-busting organization, and Angela Johnson is a very lively kind of boss of that institution, and she was the person directly responsible for taking the crime intelligence top management into custody on what is claimed to be a criminal offense linked to the appointment of a very young 29-year-old brigadier to crime intelligence. Now, I was sitting there and I was wondering, okay, what I hear here and what I see is not a criminal offense. It may be maladministration, it may be nepotism, it may be some form of administrative problems, but it does not sound to me like a criminal case. But she was very adamant that this is criminal, and especially in the parliamentary hearings, she was put under tremendous pressure, linked, of course, to her husband, which is funny enough, working at crime intelligence. And the question is emerging in the whole hearing, and I've said that last time when we spoke, it seems to me the rot in crime intelligence, it goes far deeper than what we thought. It's very difficult to determine who are the good guys and who are the bad guys. It's clear that Khumalo, General Khumalo, still has got the confidence of the National Commissioner. He still has the confidence of Lucky Makwanazi. They're defending him. They explaining that the old situation at crime intelligence is kind of a isolated problem. But it seems to me, if you look carefully at crime intelligence, the impact of somebody like General Ndluli a few years ago is still lingering in crime intelligence. I don't want to call it two factions, but there are definitely two groups looking at this problem. And I think this is very bad for the police's execution of their primary duties. It is very bad for the way in which politicians and, of course, organized crime networks work into crime intelligence. And the fact that crime intelligence was taken away from General Sabia early in the year tells us a story and where crime intelligence is going. So if I were to sum up what I've heard thus far, it seems to me that we've got weak leadership in the top of the police structure, weak managerial leadership. In other words, they have a difficulty doing a very complicated task. Secondly, we've got a dysfunctional crime intelligence where a lot of the police resources are used. And if I say resources, I do it generally, but it mainly means there's a lot of money wastage and there's a lot of questionable ways in which money is used in projects. And then, of course, all of these things is exacerbated by the impact of the crime intelligence networks. And this week, I was wondering why are they focusing so much at Madlanga, at what goes on in the East Rand, Irguleni. Why these guys are talking, the head, and there's another Makwanazi this time. Julius Makwanazi's name was mentioned several times. And I think the purpose of this week's Madlanga hearings were to show how these crime networks were not only working towards the Tembisa Hospital, and they were not only influencing the police at certain levels, but they also captured local government. They totally captured the metro government of Ekurhuleni, in the sense that they were able to drive their own cars with blue lights and things like that. That is metro capture. Maybe there's now three types of capture in this country. There's state capture, Zondo, that we know well. Then there's the capture of crime intelligence, and then there's the capture of your metro structures. And that made somebody like Kat Matlala extremely powerful. If you have your contacts in the police, in other words, you've got information far ahead of the actual implementation of, let's say, a bust or whatever the police want to do. If you've got your own blue lights and you control a metro, you've got this space, you've got this total freedom to operate any way you like. And I think that is clearly showing through the evidence that is coming through. And so those two, what happened in the East Rand and what happened at IDAC this week, was important. Mr. Or General Kumalu, in the first 2 days, was still giving the end of his evidence. But that was just a continuation of what he did last week.
Now, there have been some dramatic developments on the sidelines with the African National Congress former election fixer, Brian Mokgotsi, allegedly trying to stage his own assassination. And in the latest development, the IDAC chief investigator temporarily kidnapped and robbed of his devices.
Two very interesting guys. If you look at it objectively, you can say, okay, Brian Mokgotsi, being a fixer, got fixed himself. That is how it looks. But if you dig deeper and if you see what people are saying that were close to that incident, it may just have been his own making. So I'm very skeptical about that whole case. And the same with the IDAC investigator. You know, if they rob you and they steal all your electronic equipment, then there's nothing that you can give to Madlanga or that they can take any further. So although I would like to believe that this was a case on merit, again, in this whole case where IDAC is involved, and it seems to me the IDAC role is becoming a very complicated role. And I think the role of Mrs. Johnson is part of that. This thing is not sorted out, and it seems to me they play a very important role in terms of where these things are going. And I think one of the recommendations would be, I'm sure, is that we will have to look at what is IDAC doing, how they are doing it, and in what sense are they making a contribution. I know they do a lot of good work on corruption in general, but I think the involvement in the police, and then, of course, out of it comes three or four questions that was posed to Angela Johnson about, is she trying to prepare herself to become the next Shamila Batoyi? Would she be available for that job? Is she actually preparing herself to be the next NPA? Now, she tried to say no, she wouldn't. But then when pushed, eventually she said, well, if I'm nominated by somebody else, I would surely look at that role. So yeah, you can see there's already, it's not only in the police, where people are rallying themselves in terms of who's going to take over from Fannie Masemola. But it seems to me the position of the NPA, Shamila Batoi, that's retiring now, and I think her position must be filled early next year, is already part of a big challenge for leadership. And I think it will play out even more in Madlanga and at the ad hoc committee.
Talking about the NPA, last week we spoke about how the African National Congress was busy sanitizing the reputation of former Minister Malusi Gigaba. But now the NPA has moved to charge him with alleged procurement irregularities during his time at Transnet.
Yeah, Malusi Gigaba is a major disappointment for the ANC, because very early on, Malusi Gigaba was viewed as a possible leader in the age after the Zuma and the Ramaphosa years. In other words, let's say 2029 and further, he would now be mature enough to take over the reins of the party and the country. That was the thinking 10 years ago. And I think what Malusi Gigaba did, not only in his private life, but also in the positions that he filled, I think broke down the confidence that ANC leadership had in Gigaba. And I'm glad that the situation eventually comes out, because his role during state capture as Minister of Finance, as a gifter to the Guptas, as the signatory of all kinds of trains. I remember the budget for trains were like 39 billion. And then suddenly when Gigaba became the minister, it jumped to about over 60 billion rand. And of course, we remember Brian Molefe, and we remember Anand Singh, not Anand Singh, but Mr. Singh in that case. So I think, yes, he will probably, despite the fact that he's currently a senior member of parliament, I see the Americans refer to that as a ranking member of a committee, which means a very senior member. He is now sitting jointly at defense with a few other people. And so he's a chairman of a portfolio committee, which makes him a very important member. But if rumors are true, and that Ntunu is considering stepping aside, in other words, he's not on garden leave anymore, but he considers stepping aside, I think a very similar future is awaiting Gigaba on this case, because the stepping aside arrangement in the ANC is, if you're accused, you're still okay. But the moment there's a formal case being opened, the moment you're in court, everything changes. And we saw that with a few other members as well. So I think Malusi Gigaba is now also entering the stepping aside phase of his membership in the ANC.
Let's go internationally. U.S. President Donald Trump has announced that America is going to boycott the G20 summit in South Africa. What did you make of his latest post?
Well, what can I say? He already has said in his campaign last year that he's not happy about what goes on in South Africa. And when he became president, it was clear that he is not very enthusiastic about the G20 and South Africa's role in the G20. Those things were generally known. And then halfway through the year, it was rumored that J.D. Vance would represent the Americans here. Why is it important that the Americans should be at the G20? Well, it's like a relay race. Maybe just for general information again, the G20 doesn't have a bureaucracy. It doesn't have an organization that runs it. When you get the G20, you as a country must do all the arrangements, and you must afford all the different meetings, the business meetings, all the different meetings. And therefore, basically, as a nation, you're in control of the arrangements. And the way in which we organized it, the Americans didn't like. So last week in Social Truth or Truth Social, Trump came out guns blazing. He said, firstly, there will be no American official at the G20. And that already happened this week, where one of the task teams within the G20 was sitting in Limpopo, and they had to get an arrangement signed by all members, and the Americans refused. In other words, they can't go forward with their project because one of the 20 most important members refused to sign whatever they wanted to do. And we will now see the Americans taking the glitter off our G20. And I am curious to see how the baton is going to be moved on, because usually there's an official handing over of membership or handing over of chairmanship. We received that in Brazil last year, and the Americans must now receive it from us, but they're not here. So maybe they'll send in a very low-life official just to take the formal letter of introduction or whatever it is that they use for that purpose. But in the same week, the Americans also chickened out from COP30 that takes place in Brazil. So what Donald Trump is doing at the moment, and that is not often that we see that from any political leader, he's implementing and he's doing what he has promised. Whether you like it or not, I don't particularly like what he's doing, but I must acknowledge the fact that as a politician, he definitely does what he promised to do. And in that sense, it makes Donald Trump unique. He brings about a disruption of ways in which we see the world around us. The one thing that I know about business people is that, and businesses in general, they prefer a predictable environment, an environment where you know, for instance, we've got four seasons and the seasons is going to look like this, so we can plan for it. Or you've got this policy or that policy implemented. Donald Trump is changing these things as he goes on. And that disrupting nature of his rule is a very, very difficult one to analyze and to really understand and to predict. And then while we try to understand Donald Trump, well, in came the new mayor of New York just to spice up things in America. Now we've got somebody in New York, in my view, kind of a social democrat. Donald Trump just skipped all the social democratic crap and he calls him a communist. Straightforward comment. So there is going to be a lot of fun for us to watch how the mayor of the largest city in the U.S. and probably, apart from London, one of the most important financial hubs in the world, how this is going to pan out. So from where I'm sitting, I think it's popcorn time to watch that one.
Indeed. Thank you. That was political analyst Professor Theo Venter on the NDB Sunday Show with me, Chris Stain. Thank you, Professor.
My pleasure.